Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is Urban Nature, a podcast from Istanbul 74. I'm Gabriel Kozlovsky. I'm a Brazilian architect and curator. I work on questions pertaining urbanization from the perspective of political ecology. In Urban Nature, I talk to prominent thinkers who have been pushing the boundaries of how we understand the relationship between humans and the natural environment. Today, I have the greatest pleasure of hosting my first Brazilian guest, Eduardo Góes Neves. Eduardo is an archaeologist and anthropologist who has become one of the most important figures in the study of Amazonia's history. He has been affiliated to multiple universities in the Americas, from Brazil to the US, Peru, Ecuador, and Argentina, and is the director of the Museum of Archaeology and Ethnology at the University of São Paulo, where he teaches and leads the Laboratory of Tropical Archaeology. He also coordinates the research group Historical Ecology of the Neotropics from the Brazilian National Council for Science and Technological Development. He presided over the Brazilian Archaeology Society between 2009 and 2011 and served on the board of directors of the American Archaeology Society between 2011 and 2014. His books include Amazon Archaeology, the edited volume Unknown Amazon, Culture in Nature in Ancient Brazil, and last year, Under the Times of the Equinox, 8,000 Years of History in the Central Amazon. Eduardo, muito obrigado. I'm grateful you accepted this invitation, and I'm looking forward to our conversation today.
Thank you very much, Gabriel. It was a pleasure for me as well. Thanks for the invitation.
Fantastic. Eduardo, over the past recent years, the work of archaeologists in the Amazon has received a lot of attention and gained quite some visibility among the general public. The timing of this interview, though, is quite amazing. Just a couple of weeks ago, we had another milestone in the understanding of the extent, size, and the types of urban systems ancient civilizations created in the region. With the article 2000 Years of Garden Urbanism in the Upper Amazon, published by Science by Estefan Rostand and his group working in the Yupano Valley in Ecuador, we advance yet another step in the knowledge we have of the Amazon's past and present, which are at the core of the topics we're going to discuss today. With this in mind, I thought about starting our conversation with the theoretical foundations that enable this type of work to exist and to have meaning. I want to talk about the idea of archaeology. You once described archaeology as being the primary means to understand change in coupled human natural systems over long timescales. So there's a lot to unpack here. The question of change versus stasis, of the interrelation between human and natural systems, and of course, the question of time and processes of long duration. And when it comes to labor, archaeology ranges from implementing the state-of-the-art technology of LIDAR by drones, but also the most rustic low-tech excavation by hand. Can you present us with your view on archaeology, especially against the misconceptions that come with a certain image of the discipline, perhaps related to a practice that's concerned solely with the past?
Yes, sure. That's an interesting question, because I think archaeology overall, not only in the Amazon, has never been as interesting as a discipline as it is today. If you look at the history of archaeology, I mean, my training, my background was within a very strong tradition in the US, which connects archaeology to what we call the anthropological sciences. In a way, it's a very different trajectory that you see, for instance, in some parts of the world in continental Europe. And because of this connection with the other social sciences, archaeology, in a way, it benefited a lot from this anthropological background, theoretical background, which I think is very important, but also because we in archaeology work not only with artifacts. I mean, when people think about archaeologists, people think about people working with artifacts, with objects, with architecture, things that, you know, produced directly by human activity. But we also work with other kinds of remains, which result from human activities, but maybe we don't can call them as artifacts. Things like soil samples, like bone remains, plant remains, you know, things like that. And because of this, archaeology always being placed, although it came from a very strong, it comes from a very strong anthropological background, also kept for many years strong connections with the natural sciences. things like ecology, zoology, botany, and so forth. And this kind of hybrid placement between the humanities and the natural sciences, for many years, was a kind of a source of anxiety for archaeologists, because the archaeological theories were never as refined as the ones that we see, for instance, coming from social anthropology, where people can actually be on the ground, talk with the people, have a very refined record of things which are going on. We in archaeology normally work with, you know, remains, a sample of things that happened in the past, very fragmented. So for many years, we were in this kind of like insecure anxiety. There was this kind of epistemological anxiety, which, you know, characterized archaeological debates. If you look at the history of archaeology in the 1960s and 70s, a lot of the discussion on theoretical archaeology was whether archaeology was a science or not. How should it be? It was a very positivistic discussion. But I mean, there was a model of science, and archaeologists were desperate to try to reach this kind of standard in order to transform the discipline into a real science. What's happening in the world today is that we're living under a very strong social ecological crisis. Some people call it the Anthropocene crisis. And suddenly, archaeology became very well prepared to address these questions, because in a way, because of this kind of like hybrid subject matter that we study in archaeology, we've been addressing the connection between people and the environment over the millennium. I think archaeology is very well positioned to address these questions and bring this deep historical perspective about, you know, this connection between our species and the natural world. And in the Amazon, this is more interesting, you know, because for many, many years, I'd say for more than 100 years, the accepted wisdom about the deep Amazonian past, that comes from the 18th century, early 19th century. I can talk about this later on, but the accepted idea is that there was never many people in the Amazon, but the people who lived in the Amazon were, like, you know, actually barely surviving under very strong environmental limitations. This idea of the Amazon as a green hell. And this idea became also, which reflects much more the effects of European colonialism in the 17th and 18th century than actually some kind of like deep perspective on human indigenous presence in the Amazon. It became almost like a self-fulfilling prophecy. So many people never really bothered to work in the Amazon because there was nothing to be found there. And because people never went there, people were not finding everything. So there was like this kind of like, you know, self-circulating reasoning. But that picture began to change in the 1990s. And there was a major theoretical breakthrough that I think really contributed for this change in archaeology. And it is what we call historical ecology, which is something that comes from social anthropology and archaeology as well. And really, the basic idea of historical ecology was that, you know, indigenous people has been, not only in the Amazon, but throughout the world, people have been transforming the environment over the millennia, creating landscapes. And this kind of theoretical framework, like theoretical umbrella, really was something liberating for us doing archaeology there, because there was a meaning, there was, you know, there was a deep question that enabled us to try to understand what happened there over the long term.
Amazing. So there is a direct connection between the past and the present when we are to address these future concerns and anxieties we have, right? So archaeology offers this bridge between these time scales.
Exactly. I mean, if you look at the history of archaeology in the Amazon, as I mentioned before, for many people, the major hypothesis that, as I mentioned, people never lived there because there was, you know, there were like severe environmental limitations. So the whole idea of sustainability was placed in the research agenda from the 1950s on. I mean, the major question for many years in Amazonian archaeology was to try to understand how people, which were the limitations for people to settle in the Amazon. And that question is not only a question about the past, it's a question about the present and the future today. So it's interesting that you see the debate already in the 1970s. Some of the archaeologists, there was a very important archaeologist from the U.S. that worked for many years in the Amazon. She worked at the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C. Her name was Betty Meggers. And this scholar, Betty Meggers, she said, listen, there was never many people in the Amazon. Therefore, there could be not in the present many people living in the Amazon as well. She was very critical about the movements of contemporary settlement in the Amazon that we saw it starting in the 1970s. And she was basing her reasoning in what she believed happened in the past as well. I think she was wrong in her conception about the past, but she was very important because she was a person who really placed the issue of sustainability or the presence of human presence in the Amazon at all times And I think she opened the bridge and the door actually for something which I consider to be very important, which is the fact that you just mentioned that archaeology in the Amazon is not only about the past, but also about the present and the future as well. My colleague Michael Hickenberger, who teaches at the University of Florida, he's been talking about that for many years now, like the archaeology of the future. That's not only like a language of speech. I think it's really addressing something which is very important conceptually and politically as well.
Absolutely. And you mentioned the fact that we always had this image of the Amazon being a place that was depopulated, that was, it came with a lot of myths around that region. One that, for instance, the Amazon was a pristine and homogeneous forest. The other one is this one that you mentioned, that it was never properly populated, therefore it shouldn't be nowadays. So there are a bunch of myths that came with our progression of the understanding of the Amazon. At some point, they were completely opposed to each other. The myths, for instance, of El Dorado as this lost paradise, or as you mentioned, the green hell, and more recent, the Earth's lung. So the Amazon has always had these stereotypical images attached to it, almost kind of myths that try to explain with one word what that place that's incredibly rich and difficult to grasp because there's so much diversity on it. They try to resume it, or they try to narrow down to one image. So can you explain us what contributed to the creation of these myths? Why have we always been so reductive about the Amazon? Does it start with the navigations? Does it start with the moment, the gap between the navigations and the scientific endeavors in the Amazon? Why have we always never considered the Amazon for what it is, but for what we wanted it to be?
Oh, that's interesting. I've been trying to trace back the intellectual history of this conception, and it's interesting that there's a colleague, a historian called Neil Safier, who teaches at university at Brown University in the U.S., and he says that this image of the torrid zone, that the idea of what would be like a torrid zones, areas which are very very warm and very hot, as being like not very good for people to live. This image comes back from the Roman Empire, from the Roman times, like 2,000 years ago. So that's something that comes. It's very old in this kind of in the European tradition of thinking about places in the world. On the other hand, if you look at South America before the arrival of Europeans, the Inca also they have this very large empire in South America, all the way from Ecuador and to Chile. They also had a lot of trouble. It was an empire that developed in the Andes, high in the mountains. And for the Incas, dealing with the Antisuyu, which was a part of the empire that corresponds to the Amazon today, was something which was also very complicated. The images that they had of the tropical lowlands were associated with barbarism somehow. So we have these two instances that, in a way, meet together when the first Europeans arrived here in the 16th century. It's interesting, if you read the early chroniclers that went down the Amazon in the 1540s, the first written records that we have, they talk about places which are full of people, at the edges of the Amazon. They talk about cities at the edges of the Amazon. In the early 16th century and the early 17th century, we still see evidence of many people settled along the shore near the main channel of the Amazon. But towards the end of the 17th century and the early 18th century, that picture changed radically. And why did it did? Why did it change? Because the 17th century was a time, and that's a long story, I'm going to try to summarize it here. It was a time when the Portuguese established themselves through military outposts across the Amazon. Although the official discovery of Brazil happened in 1500 CE, the Portuguese presence in the Amazon became really like stronger in the 17th century. And there was during that time that we saw the extermination of indigenous people because of diseases, because of slavery, because of war. So when the early travelers, the scientific travelers, start going down the Amazon in the 18th century, people like Lacondamine, and then von Humboldt, and then Spix and Marsus. These people, these guys are looking around and they see places which are empty, places which were previously occupied that we know because of archaeology that have been recovered by forests. In the Amazon, we don't have any rocks. We don't have masonry. Use of raw material. The raw material for construction was soil or earth, and also wood and straw and things like that. These things, you know, wood and straw, they will disappear over time after abandonment. And the soil, you know, when earth is used as raw material, you see the vegetation growing on the top of it. So they're looking at places that we know today were densely occupying. They're seeing forests, empty areas, and that really contributed to create this image of the Amazon as an empty place. And it's interesting that I was just reading him this morning. This is very important German naturalist, Karl von Martius, who traveled in the Amazon in the early 19th century. He spent 3 years traveling to Brazil and many, you know, a lot of this time in the Amazon. And von Martius, he was really intrigued by the fact that there were so many different indigenous languages spoken in the Amazon. He was a guy, Germany at that time, he was from Bavaria. He was from the south of the south. Germany didn't exist as a country at the time, of course. But, you know, German unity was a very important issue. And language was the vehicle that really provided for the cultural unification of the country in the 19th century. So von Martius was looking at the Amazon, he was saying something totally different, many different languages. And the only thing that he could think about was that an idea of degradation, that these people who spoke different languages, they came from elsewhere, from other places in South America. He knew about the ruins in the Andes and also in Mesoamerica, about the Maya, because they were made out of stone. So what did he propose? These people came from centers, early centers of civilization. They migrated down the Amazon, didn't find environmental conditions to keep the same level of sophistication, and then became degraded. So the many languages that we see today, which is something which is really amazing in the Amazon, indigenous languages, would be a record of this process of continuous degradation of people coming from elsewhere. That idea of degradation, people moving from one place, getting down to the Amazon and devolving into simpler life forms, it became really standard all the way to the end of the 20th century. So that's, in a way, in a nutshell, that's how this idea came into being. It was much more a reflex of the early centuries of colonialism than actually now a perspective on the long-term process of occupation of the area.
That's very interesting. And if I understand correctly, one of the things that's one of the important advancements that's allowing this paradigm to change or to form a new knowledge about Amazonia is coming through the accumulation of research around what we now call archaeological dark earth, right? Or also Indian black earth, in Portuguese, Terra Preta de Índio. Eduardo, what are those dark earths and why are they so important in revealing aspects of human occupation and of the anthropic transformation of the landscapes?
Oh, those dark earths, they're really remarkable. And I spent many years working, I still do in a way, with these kinds of soils. These are, as the name mentioned, very dark soils. They come in patches. They can be up to like 90 hectares is the largest one that I found so far. And these soils, they're very fertile. They're really, you know, people plant, they look for them for planting today. And they have something which is really amazing. They're very stable. Mm-hmm. And stability is an important thing because tropical soils, they tend to lose their fertility very, very rapidly because of the, you know, extreme, you know, rainfall, very, very strong rainfall that promotes the leaching of the nutrients. The nutrients are washed away normally on tropical soils. But dark soils, they keep their nutrients, even if they're exposed. And we know today that they keep their nutrients over centuries or even like, you know, more than 1,000 years. So these soils are known since the 19th century by science. People knew about them. And they're called in Portuguese, as you mentioned, Terras Pretas de Índio, the indigenous dark soils. Because normally when we see those soils, we also see archaeological pottery on the ground. It's very common. And in many places in the Amazon, it's very easy to, like, you're traveling around, step over the boat, walk up a bluff, and then you're going to see those like, you know, high on the bluffs, so those dark soils with the ceramic sherds on the top of it. Until the 1990s, there were many different hypotheses about the development of those soils. People were talking about, you know, that they were like at the bottom of lakes in the past, that they were like volcanic ashes, or their own natural causes. But then in the 1990s, like, we have, you know, there were a couple of articles, you know, actually more than a number of scientific pieces that really established that these were created by indigenous people in the past. And that's something very important because if you recall what I just mentioned before, this idea of environmental limitations preventing large population aggregates in the Amazon in the past, this was the standard hypothesis. One of the most strong limitations appointed by those studies would be soil. The soils were very poor. They will prevent permanent forms of agriculture to develop in the past in the Amazon. And because of these limitations in the soil, people have to move around constantly, and there'll be like, some kind of barrier to population growth and the emergence of more centralized, or not even centralized, but more dense and permanent forms of habitation. But when we realized in the 1990s that those soils, the dark soils, they're not natural, but they were created by people in the past, there was a very strong argument against what we call environmental determinism. It was a very strong demonstration based on the principles of historical ecology that nature could have been transformed under like a certain kinds of technology and forms of knowledge in the Amazon in the past. So they became very important because there still are a very strong evidence of this plasticity, of this interesting interaction between people and nature in the Amazonian past.
And I know that one of the big conversations around these anthropic soils is whether they were intentionally produced or just the artifact of an unintentional human labor over time. In which side of the conversation archaeology leans to more recently?
Interesting, because as usual, like the truth lies in between somehow. But it's interesting because people accept it. So this was happening already in the early 2000s. Like everybody, most people, I think every archaeologist accepted that, and soil scientists, agronomists, that those soils were created intentionally. But then there was a division. I mean, within the people who accepted the human authorship of those soils. There's a group of people who thinks that they were created deliberately as ways to improve the soil to enable larger areas to be cultivated, which is a kind of what I'm going to call here an agronomic logic. And there was another logic, which the one that I tend to expose is that they were created at least initially, not intentionally. They were like, compost piles in the back of the houses. People became more sedentary. They're like spending more, and we know that there was climatic change starting around 3,000 years ago. Maybe even a little more. The climate became warmer and wetter in the Amazon, and we see I mean, we have to understand better this connection. But I think there's a deep connect. There's some kind of deep correlation because after this, we begin to see the establishment of large sedentary settlements across the Amazon, and the dark soils come within that package. So in my perspective, these guys, they were like sedentary folks managing resources in the forest already, having their gardens in their backyard, fishing along the rivers. And then because they were spending more time in the same place and throwing their garbage, organic garbage, lots of charcoal, bone remains, and peels like fruit, skins of plants and things like that. We have excavations in some of the sites that we see actually the pits. They're very discrete features that we see the pits with these kinds of things. So they begin to realize that as they're adding these things to the soil, they knew that already, I think. The soil became more fertile and that they could eventually plant some, special, like tobacco, maybe like, a strong kind of pepper, medicinal plants, things like that around their houses. So in my perspective, it was initially something which was not intentional, but then people became aware of it and they were managing soil eventually and using those areas for cultivation as well. There was a paper published, I think it was last year or maybe the year before last already. The lead author is Morgan Schmidt, who's an archaeologist and geographer who lives in Brazil. He's from the US. And Morgan, based on his work in the Upper Xingu, here area in the Brazilian Amazon, with the Quicuru indigenous people, she showed that the Quicuru, they still produce dark soils today, and that they are aware that they manage the soil and that management enhances soil fertility. And how do they do it? They compost in the back of their houses. They throw organic garbage, manage them, use fire at low temperature, and then using this, they create those dark soils. So I think we know today, of course, there was intention in the creation of those soils, but I disagree with the idea that people were like doing them in a large scale in order to, like, provide for large areas for cultivation. I think this kind of reasoning reproduces the reason that we see today, that in a way destroying the Amazon, that you have to, like, improve the Amazon for it to serve some kind of, like, wider or stronger economic needs. I don't know if I answer you very well, but
I think it's fantastic. That's exactly what I wanted to know. So there is there are evidences that it came out of this progression of occupation when society started to settle, but then they kind of realized the potential and turned that into a technology almost, like that they could use from time to time punctually in some places in order to enhance the fertility.
Yes.
I think this is actually a very good point for us to dive deeper into the topic of human-induced transformations of landscapes, because I think this is a big topic today. And I know that many of your studies and those of your colleagues reveal how the existence of pre-Columbian complex Amazonian societies is associated with evidences of large-scale transformations of the natural environment, not only around dark earths, but also in the environment in general, in the broader environment, that these historical societies had major impact on plant and animal communities, hydrology and soils, to the point that they modified the constitution of the Amazonian landscape itself. And this is a major realization that I think it requires one to visualize a different time scale of human action over an area that's the size of a continent in the end. Can you explain us a bit how these transformations took place and what is the polemic around the term niche construction that we see a lot divergences around when applied to the Amazon?
That's an interesting point also, because it's when my colleagues and myself, we begin to publish these ideas, maybe like 20 years ago, or a lot of our colleagues, in the academic community, people like working with biological, with conservation biology, they were really annoyed because basically, and I think I understand why they were annoyed. They're basically saying, if you guys are saying that, there's okay, that there's been lots of people living in the Amazon, we believe that there were between 8 and 10 million people living in the Amazon at the time of the arrival of the Europeans here in the Americas. And these fellows, they were saying, if you guys are saying that there were many people living in the Amazon in the past, that it means that it is okay for people to come today and basically destroy the Amazon. Of course, we are not saying this, but I think it was an important, warning for us to be more careful in the ways we presented our ideas. So there was this discussion about, niche construction for that matter. Some people, I would say more in the biological sciences, they were very reluctant to accept that there was any kind of like indigenous contribution into the development or the coevolutionary history of the Amazon that we know today. Mm-hmm. But then in the last 5 years, or even maybe a little bit more, there are so many, the papers coming from different places in the Amazon, because archaeological data, it takes a while for it to mature. You have to do the collection and the field work. I mean, some of the sites are very large and our excavations are very small, because you're working sometimes in places which are very far away, the logistics are very complicated, so it takes a long time for us. And then we have to bring all the samples to the labs. We work with different labs in different places here in Brazil and abroad as well. It takes a while for the data to emerge. But as the data has been emerging, not only from the projects that I work with, but from other projects as well, it's becoming more and more clear that there were people pretty much everywhere in the Amazon. And some of these guys were living in cities, like, tropical urbanism. We can talk more about this in a moment, but there's very, very strong evidence of ancient indigenous presence throughout the Amazon and things which are associated with it, the dark soils that we mentioned before. We have evidence of roads, ancient roads. We have evidence of earthworks, like levees, like platforms, throughout the Amazon. We have evidence of changes in plant composition. There's an interesting study published 10 years ago, roughly, that talks about, it was an inventory of three species in the Amazon. And it shows that there was, although there are like around 16,000 tree species in the Amazon, there's a very small number of those species, around 227, that contribute to almost half of the individuals in the Amazon. It means that there are many species, there are many trees, but there's a very small amount, only 1.5% of those species, which are what they call hyperdominant. And if you look at the hyperdominant species, a lot of them are useful plants, foodstuff or like technological plants. It's interesting. There was a paper just published a couple of weeks ago that shows there seems to be a similar hyperdominant pattern, not only for the Amazon, but for other tropical forests as well, in the Congo, in Africa, and also in Asia. So I had to understand better the data from the other places. But I think that's an indication that this, interconnection, this very ancient and deep interconnection between people and trees, in this case, that we see in the Amazon prevailed elsewhere in the world as well. So I think that's something. I mean, ecological data, botanical data, soil data. I mean, there's archaeological data, of course, really shows that we have this deep interconnection. Of course, as archaeologists, our role and our task is to try to understand how this process unfolded over time. We have between 12 and 13,000 years of indigenous presence in the Amazon, and the history was never, it was never like, never happened along the same line. So as archaeologists, what we do is try to qualify how those transformations unfolded over the millennia. But it's something which is really, I tend to see that this question is being settled. And the challenge for us scientists, natural scientists, social scientists, is to find ways to incorporate them together, to think about, potential, manners to deal with the challenges that the Amazon faces today, and to do that with indigenous people, which I think is very important.
Yes, absolutely. And if we're talking about these species that became a very small percentage of species that became dominant, and there are evidence that this comes from a certain type of manipulation of the landscape, I think it allows us to reflect more on the idea of the human relationships with other non-human species, right? These processes of transformation in the end are also processes of domestication. And you mentioned this several times because this is a domestication that that comes from a conscious manipulation in the landscape's ecology and the landscape ecology and the demographics of its plants and animal populations that in the end result in more productive and maybe pleasant environment for humans. But it's also a type of domestication of nature that archaeology began showing very early on, and as you have argued, represents an entanglement between nature and culture. And I think this is a very powerful realization that it's not either nature or culture in two sides of the equation, but a kind of process of joining this understanding of these two entities into one. So can you expand on this idea and processes of domestication and the entanglement it creates between humans and other species?
Yes, I mean, the concept of domestication is very important for archaeology. And one of the champions, one of the major proposers of this concept was what I think was probably the most important archaeologist of the 20th century, this fellow called Gordon Child. He was an Australian archaeologist who, had his whole academic career in the UK at UCL, most of the time at UCL and the Institute of Archaeology in London. And Gordon Child, he wasn't a field worker. He wasn't a guy who like went to the field a lot. Well, he was a great synthesizer. He was a Marxist archaeologist, and he wrote things in the 1930s, which I mean, of course, it's been almost 100 years, but they remain very fresh today. So he coined in the 1930s, he coined an expression which is very important called Neolithic Revolution. He was a Marxist archaeologist, so he believed that human history happened, and historical change happened through major revolutions. And one of them would have been the Neolithic Revolution. And one of the key concepts within the so-called Neolithic Revolution, what was the Neolithic Revolution? It was the time that when we ceased to be hunters and gatherers in the past, and then we became food producers. We became to cultivate plants and raise livestock. And one of the key concepts for the so-called Neolithic Revolution was the idea of domestication. Was the idea that humans imposed genetic changes in animals and plants, transforming those wild animals into domesticated animals, bringing them to the dimension of the house. Because domestication comes from domus, which is a Latin word for house. So that's an interesting idea, and I think it works in some places in the world. But what's interesting in the Amazon, if you look at the number of plants which are cultivated today by indigenous people, and have been cultivated for thousands of years. Some of them were never domesticated. Some of them are technically speaking wild. They never have been transformed from a wild plant into a new species. If you look at maize, for instance, corn, which is a very important plant, which was domesticated in Mexico, there are clear signs of domestication. Wild maize, it's called teosinte, it's one species. And then that species was managed by indigenous people and became a new species, which is the one that we know today, Zea maize, or we call maize or corn. Manioc was also, it's an Amazonian plant, was also modified and became another species. But many other important, when I say crops from the Amazon, like the Brazil nuts, like the açaí palm, they were never really fully transformed. They are technically speaking wild. So when I begin to look at this in the night, 10 years ago, 2000 and 2010, sitting around this time, our first reaction as archaeologists working in Brazil at the periphery of the centers of production of knowledge was to say, well, these guys, I'm calling something which is wrong, but that's the way kind of I used to think around the time. Well, we don't even have a complete Neolithic revolution here. We're like, we left behind in this process of changing from we the people who lived here from being hunter-gatherers into becoming full-fledged farmers. But then looking at the data and there was some conceptual changes happened in social anthropology here in the Amazon. But also very importantly, indigenous people begin to speak, and their speeches and their knowledge began to be accepted in the academic sphere, and that was a revolution. I think it was like a major theoretical philosophical revolution, if I say, because one of the things that they've been saying that forever, and they were saying that again, and they're still saying that over and over again, is that this idea, I mean. The idea of domestication, and that's me talking now, it's based on an award view, on an ontology that separates the world of nature from the world of culture. And that nature is there for us to be transformed and modified according to our own needs. And indigenous knowledge tells us that there's no such a thing as a very strong and well-defined break between the worlds of culture and the worlds of nature. And if you follow this assumption, which I think is really beautiful and correct, it doesn't really make sense to see if a plant is domesticated or not. These are categories that we created. They are heuristic categories. They work well to explain some things, but they should not be like straitjackets that force us to organize the world into these categories. So in a way, the fact that we have so many important plants which were never domesticated in the Amazon, that it's I think it's actually very interesting. It means that we're dealing with systems of knowledge, with ontologies that operate into this integration between the worlds of nature and the world of culture that doesn't really make a strong distinction between something being domesticated or not. So what seemed to be a problem, some kind of conflict between theory and data 15 years ago, actually became something interesting. It made me rethink, this whole theoretical perspective based on my own archaeological practice, coming with some hypotheses which I hope can be more interesting for us to address these questions, not only here in the Amazon, but elsewhere in the world.
It deals with so many, it almost changes, it turns the table and shows that we don't have to only adhere from knowledge coming from elsewhere, but that our own local peoples can help us generate knowledge from the places that sometimes we overlook even. But I had a note on a concept you use that I think it fits very well with your explanation now, which is the idea that perhaps the term domestication, it's not the most proper one. And you have suggested that there is a view that benefits from the idea of familiarization instead. I would like to elaborate here a little bit because I think it constitutes a kind of a complex ecosystem almost. Like you mentioned in one of your recent papers, ethnologist Aparecida Vilaça's suggestion that the relationship of these societies with plants is part of a general concern for, open quotes, making kin out of others, and close quotes, which follows a similar line of exploration that Levi-Strauss' idea of openness to others opened some time ago, or kind of a general orientation of Amerindian societies towards alterity rather than self-identity. And you give examples of Amazonian cultures where manioc that's just mentioned is raised rather than cultivated as a plant. It's raised as a child or as pets, or where spiritual beings are believed to take part in this female act of familiarization with plants. And thus, the boundaries of domesticated and the wild are no longer exist, or what you say, the frontier between garden and forest remains fluid in the end. And when I was reading these things, it makes me think a lot about the depiction of gardens throughout history. Gardens as evoking forms of universality. They are always expression of microcosms or encapsulations of a broader system or a broader whole. Gardens are a form of making something that sometimes is completely legible into something legible, or something unknown into a knowable, and then something once becomes knowable, it becomes subject to care. The great French gardener Gilles Clément has suggested to view the world as a total garden. I find such a poetic view. It's a garden encapsulated by the biosphere. And because the limits are not the world, this is a form of entrusting the world to our care, of having a certain responsibility over it. Do you think this concept of familiarization that demands the act of caring about something, and not simply of imposing control, as could be associated with domestication, can be a model for us to learn from and establish a more caring relationship with what we consider natural?
Yes, sure. And I think that's very nice the way you frame it, which is, it's very interesting, very eloquent. I mean, the idea of familiarization, it was proposed by a friend and a colleague of mine called Carlos Fausto, who is a brilliant Brazilian anthropologist. And it's interesting because Carlos and myself, we're having a beer one night many years ago. And we're talking about, like, as friends go, like talking about life and then talking about work. And then, I was telling him this is, I was like, I was toying with this idea. This was like more than 10 years ago about, like, we don't have like a Neolithic that fully happened in the Amazon. How can we frame this? And Carlos was coming from this, from his perspective as a very active ethnologist. He's always in the field. He works together with different indigenous people in Brazil, in the Amazon, the Paracanã, the Quicuru. He speaks their languages. He's a very
Wow.
sophisticated, and he's very committed to their well-being, works together with them, does films. He's a very gifted and brilliant social anthropologist. So we're talking about these things. And then Carlos, he was the guy who said, maybe we should change the vocabulary. Maybe, like, we're looking at, we're trying to frame these things like using a vocabulary which is too limited
Yes.
to the things that we're trying to explain. We're not trying to look at the connection between people and plants using the vocabulary of kinship, and not trying, if we, because if we, in a way, we're talking about meaning and the meanings that people attribute to nature and to their practice as well. And maybe, like, this old idea of domestication is too mechanical, is too agronomic in the Western tradition, nature to be there to be transformed. But if we try to change the vocabulary and look at these connections between using the lenses of, for instance, of kinship, we can come with something which is more interesting. And that's how the idea of familiarization came about. That's something that Carlos proposed and had applied this, or he had already applied this. He noticed something which is very interesting, that many people, that's very common in the Amazon for people to take pets from the forest, like monkeys, but other animals as well. And they're never killed, they're kept. And they become kins. They're made kins. Like, they receive names. They enter through kinship this order, the social order of these communities. So he said, we're not thinking about plants along the same lines. And he had evidence, for instance, working with the Quicuru in the Upper Xingu, how, planting of piqui trees. And he has wonderful films of these things as well, showing how people, like, for instance, when the Quicuru plants a piqui tree, piqui is a tree that we see here in parts of Brazil, which is very, the fruit is very appreciated by people who live not only in the Amazon, but in other places as well. It's a very
characteristic fruit of different parts of this part of South America. And when they cocoon, they plant a pequi tree, they draw an alligator around the seedling because the tree, there's a connection between the pequis and alligators, which are like important creating figures. So this, it's very, in a nutshell, it's very difficult to separate the what we call symbolic, which is like, you know, again, it's another artificial division that we make between the practical and the symbolic. And we know that these things, they don't make any sense for many other communities in the world. But I'm just keeping this for the sake of clarity here. It's very hard to separate the symbolic dimension from the practical dimension. And I think by doing this, we're trying to offer a different way to understand these processes. And what's interesting is that, I mean, if you look at the way agriculture, Brazil really relies, the whole agricultural business is very important for Brazil right now. It generates a lot of money. It's a very important sector of the Brazilian economy. So I don't want to be irresponsible here. But I mean, but the way it works, like highly mechanized agriculture, plants, they became basically like numbers.
Yes.
It's like, it's really like they're not even, almost not living beings anymore. They're objects which are planted, deeply controlled. You know, there's like, you know, what people call precision agriculture. It's kind of remarkable in a way, but kind of like, you know, crazy, scary in the other, because every individual there, it doesn't have an identity. It's just a number, but it's, you know, although it doesn't have an identity, it's very much controlled in terms of our soil nutrients and fertility and stuff like that. It's very, and in a way, that's not a surprise for me that what we saw, there was an attempt at a coup d'etat here in Brazil a year ago. And a lot of the reactionary forces were backing up this extreme right-wing political movement are linked to this high-tech agribusiness. I mean, these are very totalitarian ways of dealing in the world, dealing with people or dealing with plants. And if you look at familiarization on the other side, it's a much more open and kind of,
it's,
you know,
the opposite.
Yeah, it's the opposite. May I say relaxed, maybe even, I mean, it's just, I mean, it's there.
Yes.
And plants, they have like, you know, this, you know, there's a literal an affinity between people and plants. People talk with plants sometimes. They have like, you know, they establish these long-term connections. When women get married, sometimes they bring those plants. They're lineages of plants, like the families of plants, not family in the scientific linear term, but families in the kinship term, which are brought along with them. That's another way of, you know, seeing these connections between people and nature. And what we see today happen in the world, I think, when I can talk about my corner of the world, which is the Amazon, we see the clash between these two ontologies in a way, like, you know, familiarization, using this expression, from one hand, like, you know, thousand-year-old forms of knowledge, and there's like, you know, totalitarian, you know, deeply industrial connected, financial connected to the financial market, you know, agribusiness sector. And we have to find a way to consider these things, because this is something which is really, I mean, there shouldn't be room for for everything, I think.
But it offers also a beautiful, as you said, are completely different ontologies, but one that offers us a more profound beauty on how we see how we try to shift from a highly anthropocentric existence to one that embraces other species.
Yeah.
But Eduardo,
sorry to interrupt.
Please.
But again, just go back to something we talked about in the beginning. It's a connection between, we're talking about the future here.
Yeah, exactly.
You're using archaeology, you know, archaeology, you know, kind of backs up the things that I'm saying. And it's important to talk about the past, but the discussion that we're having now, it's about the future. So it's something which is really concrete about doing archaeology in the Amazon.
Exactly. Which type of societies we want, which type of world we want. But what I wanted to do now is to turn our focus for a moment on the types of societies that archaeological findings have begun to show in the Amazon. Currently, there has been so much evidence that the consensus is that Amazonian was a populated region, but not only populated, but it was a complex mosaic of multiple cultures and languages in densely settled social formations. Not nomad hunter-gatherers, as we initially supposed, and as a lot of people still supposes, but as sedentary societies. Yet there is a lot that has been, let me reframe it. I think when we talk about sedentary societies, sometimes people associate the term with signs of the formation of institutions, of political systems, of centralization of power, of hierarchical social configurations that used to be typical of the signs of sedentary cultures elsewhere. And I think the question here deserves to be opened in two, because there's a lot to discuss. One is that concerns the characteristics and social and political arrangement of these societies. And another one that concerns their urban configuration and territorial distribution. So I wanted to talk about the two, but let's first start with the initial one, because then I can add more context to the second, being an architect and an urban designer, right? I would also like to expand on the other one. So can you paint us a picture of how these Amazonian societies could have been, and what is it special about this landscape that has yielded a vastly different human scenario and trajectory of evolution than those observed in other non-tropical forest environments?
Well, the first thing that we have to consider is that the Amazon is very big. It's the size of the continental U.S. It's like seven million square kilometers, roughly. If we consider the greater Amazon, not only the Amazon basin, but also the parts of Venezuela, the Orinoco, the upper Orinoco basin, the Guyana as well. So it's very, very big. And within this huge area, there's a lot of cultural variability. We know there's in the east, we see the influence of the Atlantic. We have the main channel of the Amazon that comes from the Andes. In the west, the influence from the Andes. And then, like, you know, culturally speaking, in the mouth of the Amazon, we see very strong connections with the Caribbean. In Western Amazon, naturally, it's like, you know, some connections with the Andes. In the Central Amazon, is a different story. So there's a lot of very geographical variability and also cultural variability within the Amazon as well. Right. I mean, there are different estimates, but some people talk about around 300 languages being spoken within the greater Amazon. And, you know, grouped into 50 families, or many of them are isolated, or like 50 language families or language units. You should think about it. I mean, in Europe, we're speaking in English now, but our native language is Portuguese. I mean, they're both Indo-European languages. They belong to one single language family. Almost all languages spoken in Europe today, like Polish, Russian, Portuguese, the Celtic languages, English, German, whatever, Italian, they're all Indo-European languages. There are some exceptions, like Estonian, Hungarian, and Finnish, and Basque also, which is a little isolated language. But most languages spoken in Europe today, for instance, fall into one single language family, which is Indo-European. In the Amazon, we have around 50 language families, not only language. So there's a lot of language diversity. That's something which is really interesting. It brings me back to von Martius, the guy that I mentioned in the beginning of the German, the Bavarian naturalist that we mentioned in the beginning of the talk. I'm going to talk a little bit about that later. But what's interesting is that it's as we see so much language diversity, and as I've been trained, as I mentioned initially, in this anthropological tradition, which is very strong here in the New World in the U.S., I mean, we see language diversity as a proxy for cultural diversity. So we can say that there's lots of cultural diversity in the Amazon in the present. And if you look at the archaeology, you're going to see that in the past as well. How can you tell about this? How can you say that there was lots of cultural diversity? For instance, you know, the objects which were produced by indigenous people. If you look at the ceramics are very good markers, because if you take a lump of clay, if you're a good potter, you can basically make everything you want of it. So it's very, you know, malleable, very flexible. So ceramic variability, it's a good, you know, way to establish cultural variability as well. And we see lots of different ceramic technological traditions and stylistic traditions as well. By the way, the oldest ceramics of the Americas were made in the Amazon. That's something which is also very interesting. Wow. That's another topic. But and in terms of social organization, many different things. We see people living in cities, I think. We can talk about urbanism in the Amazon. There's evidence of people living with lots of mobility as well. Some people are living on the top of shell mounds, which are like, you know, hills made out of shells. Some people are, you know, building, you know, earthworks. People living in areas with open savannas, which were flooded, like in Bolivia and also in here in Brazil, in Marajó Island, in the Central Amazon, like those dark soils. Yes. I don't think there was one single way of life that we can see characterizing the lifestyles of people in the Amazon in the before, you know, in the ancient past. The only thing that I think we can say, maybe everything can change, but I don't think we have the evidence to say at this moment is that there was something like the state. There was never like a centralized state in the Amazon as we see elsewhere in South America. But I mean, and why do I say this? Because we don't really see very strong forms of political coercion, of like organizing, like large storing areas for storage, for instance, tributation, like the construction of very large artificial like cultivation structures. We don't see this, I think, in a way that could be a mark, like, very strong mark, marks of different. If you look at burials, for instance, in archaeology, one way to talk about social inequality is to dig cemeteries because, some people are buried lots of like offerings together with them and others aren't. So these differences in terms of like, funerary offerings may be a marker of social inequality. We don't really see that, in a very marked way in the Amazonian past. So I don't think we can talk about the state, but we can see that, aside the state, we see like all sorts of forms of political organization all the way to the time of the arrival of the Europeans. And that's something which I think is really interesting as well.
So it means that perhaps Amazonian societies, they were more horizontal, less hierarchical, perhaps, in their social configuration.
I think that, I mean, there's always someone that wants to be a boss and to rule things out. And I think that happened in the Amazon in the past as well. And I think there was probably, there were probably contexts where very charismatic people like shamans or headmen, they really like had the power and the charisma to hold lots of communities together under their rule. But I don't see, I've never seen up to the moment, I don't think we have evidence that these forms of political coercion, they reproduce themselves over time. And why do I say this? Because I think the production in the Amazon, because of the abundance of resources, this kind of we call agroforestry strategies, the cultivate this kind of open perspective towards cultivating, this lack of absolute control, in a way, it's almost like the antithesis, the opposite. It doesn't really provide the glue for the establishment of like long-term political coercion in the long run. So I think people, I can see like some very powerful headman like commanding people to make like chicha, like a maize or many of beer for them, like during these big parties, showing how generous and how important and how much symbolic capital that person would have. But I don't see necessarily the grandkids or the offspring of that this powerful men or women maybe having this, being able to keep that, social, this pattern of social control working based only on charisma. So there was something always like, I think there was always something in the long term moving people, pushing them away from the center in the long run.
That's very interesting and also ties perfectly to the second part of the same question that's about their spatial expression. I think that first there were some when we started understanding or being sure that Amazon has hosted large societies, first there was a type of perhaps an early conception or an idea that these societies would occupy mainly the floodplains. But that we now know that it's not only about floodplains, but and because of anthropic dark earths, we see that inland of the Amazonia were connected by kilometers of roads and fluvial routes composing of low density urban arrangements. And you mentioned in the beginning of the conversation, Michael Heckenberger, with whom you worked closely and published lots of things together. He has suggested that the image of galactic clusters in the Upper Xingu region, right, which he described as, open quotes, supra-local village communities organized and linked by radio networks. So there is a kind of territory intelligence, if we can put it that way, with the configuration of urban patterns and village scapes that with each discovery blows more our minds. The question is, should we then think of the Amazon as an urban forest, as Berta Becker had suggested early in the 70s, albeit in a different context? Is it correct to say that the historical Amazonian urbanism inaugurated a new chapter in the history of civilizations, And do archaeologists think these configurations are unique to this forest environment or also expected to be replicated somewhere else, like you started hinting at some other tropical environments?
Interesting. Yeah, it's interesting with Mike Heckenberger. I remember when he published this article in 2008. I think he published it Science, and he was talking about urbanism in the Amazon. A lot of people were skeptical among the archaeologists, and he was like really criticized by people, archaeologists working elsewhere. And Mike, he's a dear friend, and he's always thinking ahead, and he always tells me that it's funny because archaeologists really criticize him, but urbanists really loved him, and he was always invited to talk to urbanists. The people who deal with things like definitions and concepts related to urbanism had no problems about the things that he was saying, but archaeologists were
That's
really, really annoyed. So it's something. It's very interesting. So, but I think this picture is changing, as we mentioned today, and I think he hinted at something which is really, really. I think he was really right, and he still is. This idea of like garden cities or the galactic, polis cities, because it's when people think about urbanism, tradition, and again, you're the ones who are coming from urban studies, so you correct me if I'm talking as an archaeologist, as someone from urban studies or urban planning. But the idea that, when you have something like a city or urbanism, you're creating like a hinterland in a way. And there's a very sharp distinction between the domains of the city and the domains of the hinterland. Which is in the same, it's the same conceptual matrix that draws the line, the very strong line between the worlds of nature and the worlds of culture, domesticated and wild. It's like this basic, oppositions that they've been working under this, ontology that informs, the way our society lives in the world today. And when Michael was talking about guarding cities, he was just basically saying, listen, this is like there's no strong distinction between the worlds of. And that's something. That's why I like better to talk about urbanism than to talk about cities, because cities may be like it's too loaded a concept. It's like in a way agriculture. It's important, but I mean that's why I like to talk more about cultivation than agriculture, because agriculture implies that you're dealing with domesticated plants, whereas cultivation you're cultivating anything, wild or domesticated. It doesn't really matter. You bring it under your attention. Under like the care of family care, so we use the image of familiarization. And I think urbanism, and Michael is right. I mean, it's again, I think that's he's the guy who really pointed for the direction in archaeology. It's a more general exception because it really includes demographic aggregation and things that we can call mega villages or cities, whatever, however you want to call them. But I think the most important thing is calling attention for the networks established among these communities and the kinds of landscapes that they produce. And those landscapes, they're built into a very nuanced perspective that really doesn't really separate, again, the dimensions of the house of the settlement and the dimensions of nature. So I really like the concept of garden cities. I think that's a very interesting, important concept. And it's interesting that the paper that you mentioned in the beginning of the talk by Rostan and his colleagues, and my friends, I know these guys, we well know each other, published about the Upano. It's an interesting paper because they're talking about like it's the Upano is really serious, like very large, earthworks, roads connecting them. But the picture that they're presenting to us, and of course we have to test this with further, paleo environmental data. It's again of like garden landscapes. It's a very nuanced network between the worlds of nature and the words of culture. That's something that, I mean, they didn't have to say this, but I know that they know this because there's this cultural geographer called William Denevan, who's very influential for all of us. He's still Bill, he's more than 90 years old. He's still alive. And he's a very influential thinker, and because he's a geographer. So he really blends nature and culture. He's been very active in the Amazon from the 1950s all the way to the 2000s. And Bill Denevan, he called attention. There's a small paper that he wrote saying, listen, these guys were farming with stone axes. And if you farm with stone axes, it's a different connection to nature. It's not that you go there, you fell like a 1 hectare plot in a month with a metal axe or a chainsaw, then you burn it and you have like this very beautiful square garden. Those gardens in the past, they were like, kind of amorphous. They were like amoeba shaped. sometimes a tree would fall, people like grow on that place where the tree fell. There was no, even geographically speaking, physically speaking, there was no boundary, like a straight line between,
So
again,
good.
the dimensions. Yeah. And I think Garden City is really, it's something that connected to this worldview. It's an ontological thing, but it's also technological. And I'm establishing a distinction between technology and ontology. And we know that technology is not neutral, it's informed by ontologies all the time. So just for the sake of the conversation here, but I mean, it seems to make sense to me. It's a very elegant formulation that he proposed. And I think it really works for understanding these connections, the production of landscapes.
I am one of the people who works in urban studies, and I'm a big advocate of the use of the term urbanization as an expanded concept. I don't like the word cities at all. It's too restricted. It's too 20th century. It's impossible to distinguish the edges, what happens with the productive landscapes around it. So for me, to see that there were ancient civilizations in the middle of the forest establishing what we now think could be the future. I mean, of course, in a different context and with different technology, but one future in which there is less of a distinction between what is natural and what is the built environment, for me, is fantastic. But now I'd like to end the conversation, closing a full circle, weaving kind of past, present, and future, and how knowledge of a period impacts the other. Like we hinted at when you define archaeology, we should look at the consequences of these trees, of these historical findings, to our future and to the future of the Amazon region. It is about now, and it is about understanding where we come from and where we're going to. You have been vocal about how the things we have been dealing with can have positive, if not groundbreaking, contributions in questions pertaining to the management of our forests, questions of social justice, problematization rather than dismissal of the human factor in forest settings, and even a revision of our political systems. That the model of tropical societies has the power, for example, to offer alternatives to the business as usual of development, in open quotes, embedded in notions about progress and development that became naturalized, but that ultimately stem from 19th century evolutionist thinking that for sure it's outdated by now. So can you share your vision and the lessons we can learn from this multidisciplinary engagement with Amazonia's past?
As I told you, like when the beginning of our conversation, I think archaeology is really has never been so cool and so interesting as it is today. And I've been doing this for almost 40 years now, and I love being an archaeologist. I think archaeology, it's almost like wearing, like, you know, special lenses that, like, it becomes very difficult to separate the present, the past, and the future. I mean, if I see some kind of landscape configuration today, as an archaeologist, I try to understand the history of it, even if I'm traveling in a place, and I try to look at the future of it as well. And one of the things that I see, for instance, that, you know, something which is very important for us as archaeologists is the idea that things, they have a life, objects, they have a social life. So if I look, so I'm traveling to the countryside here in Brazil, and I see a huge sugarcane plantation, I think about, you know, the machinery which is being used to produce that. I think about what's happening to the soil of that place, to the water which is being used, to the nutrients that have been added. Where do the nutrients come from? I see that it's a very complicated and complex, you know, production chain that involves, it goes much beyond the local dimension. And I think that these structures, although they're very complex, they're also very fragile. I think they're very, you know, because they're tied into this worldwide, we see that, you know, we had a glimpse of that in the pandemic. They're very complicated, very complex, but if something really serious happens, just, you know, disrupting those chains, they're prone to fall apart. Also, the use of water that they have, mechanized intensive agriculture, we see that happening in the U.S. a lot now, in different, not only in the Southwest, but in other places as well, in the Midwest as well. The intensive use of water is draining the water tables. And I suspect something like that may be happening here. Not even talking about rainwater, I'm talking about water coming from the underground. So I think that these intensive productive systems I don't, I'm not sure. I mean, they are wonderful in some in their ways. I mean, they're very productive. They feed somehow people in the world. But as an archaeologist who's used to thinking the long term, I cannot see those things happening in the next decades. I cannot see these things happening in the next 50 years. I think they're really prone to a very, serious collapse. And if I look at these ancient agroecological systems that we see in the Amazon and elsewhere in the world, I mean, these are very old, they're very robust. I'm going to use a little fashionable word, they're very resilient. They've been there for thousands of years and they're still working. And they're producing nature in a way, they're producing landscapes. So and again, going back to this, the thing you're saying, it's very hard to separate the past from the future. I'm looking at this thing and I'm thinking about the future, using the past as my way, as my grounding for making these comparisons. And again, I think we live in different times, but I'm also hopeful. I think we have the conditions to keep on struggling, and doing something to make the world a better place. So I don't think we should give up. And I think theoretically we know what we should do now. It's not easy, but I think being an archaeologist, it's something which is really I'm thankful because I think it helps me see the world in a very interesting way.
Wow, it certainly helps me to see the world in a different way. Eduardo, thank you so much. This has been really an intellectual treat. Thank you so much. I admire everything you do, and for my own work, it has been an inspiration. Even if we are from different areas, I think in the end, everything is just one area, from the area of human nature. And so, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much, Gabriel. It's been a pleasure as well. Thank you.